Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Deepest Lore. We continue with Pandora's Box. It's going to be Goodbye, Mrs. Ant this week. We're going to be watching the whole thing, as we've been doing the past, for these shorter Pandora Box episodes. We're going to watch the whole thing. Want to keep the stream nice and lean and mean, so get your super chats in early. I'll remind everybody, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency. Buy it now. And for the third time this week, I'm going to play the Trivium because I just think it goes hard. So let's listen to the Trivium promo. And then when we come back, we're going to be looking at Goodbye, Mrs. Ant.
Now from the Academic Agency.
Pick up the Trivium today. Now, just one more thing to mention. 7,800 is the threshold. If this episode gets more than that, Adam Curtis will continue. Horus will be on next week's episode, which is about black power. Sounds like it's going to be interesting, but that will be cancelled, and the whole rest of Adam Kurtz will be cancelled if the episode does not get above 7,800. All right, goodbye, Mrs. Ant. Let's go.
If you were a scientist, you were in.
Science. I'm your faithful servant.
Building a new world.
Thomas Midgley was born in 1889. He became a chemist and an inventor. In 1921, he solved the problem of knocking in car engines. He put lead in petrol. In 1930, he discovered a new coolant for fridges. It was called by its initials, CFC. Midgley became part of a golden age of chemistry in America in the 30s.
Chemistry, alchemy, magic. The modern laboratory of today's chemist, fantastic in appearance as it is, is far out in the very vanguard of progress.
I don't know. I'm going to try to pause it as little as possible, but I don't know if any of the rest of you get this general impression. But I get the general impression that, how can I put this? I get the impression that real science was done in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, and that somehow, just like everything else, since 1945, science has somehow been corrupted by the pervading ideology of our time. And difficult to shake that feeling for me. I'm not just talking about biology and gender and race and things like that. I'm talking about like physics and chemistry and all of it, basically. I get the sense, my spidey senses sense that something dishonest goes on, and that it's perverted in a way that it didn't used to be. That's just a hunch I have. Anyway, let's continue.
Holy of Holies, wherein science moves in mysterious ways her wonders to perform.
In 1935, Midgley predicted that in the future, chemistry would solve many of the world's great problems. The ozone layer, he said, could be altered to control the sun's rays and allow scientists to govern the world's agriculture. In 1940, Midgley contracted polio. He built a pulley system to lift himself in and out of bed. But in 1944, he became trapped in it and strangled himself. That same year, the American Army began mass producing CFC to help spray a new, some said miracle, chemical over the Pacific battlefields. It killed insects. It was called DDT.
16. Also the name, of course, of Jake the Snake Roberts' special move in wrestling move, the DDT. But anyway, that actually stood for Damien's Dinner Time, but obviously the original name was this.
Project officer on the first aerial application of DDT that was ever made in the world, I guess. And we flew it over several square miles of jungle, and I was walking around some trails we'd cut in the jungle floor, and there was an incredible, describable rain of insects of all kinds coming down out of the tops of these huge jungle trees, 100 to 130, 40, 50 feet. We got cerambycid beetles, beetles of all descriptions that probably many people had never seen, or if anybody had ever seen, because they're in the tops of the trees. I remember particularly some.
Just like to say that I've always loved the aesthetics of the early 20th century, mid-20th century museum, possibly even the late Victorian museum. The aesthetics of those museums are brilliant. I remember going to the Natural History Museum when I was a kid. I was really into dinosaurs. And this is kind of reminding me of some of the back rooms in there. I just love those bits of museums that haven't changed for like 70 years and things. Yeah, they've probably all been ruined now. I haven't been for a while. But, you know, there were some great ones in Oxford as well. You know, I remember going to see some, like, shrunken heads and stuff like that. Awesome.
Think of these longhorn beetles that were coming down. There were wild.
My favourite dinosaur was the Apatosaur. The Apatosaur. And because I was a little dipshit kid, my little fact, ha-ha! Was that the Brontosaurus didn't exist. And I used to, if a teacher would mention the Brontosaurus, I'd say, excuse me, sir, excuse me, miss, the Brontosaurus doesn't exist. It was a confusion. It was actually the Apatosaur. I loved sauropods. And I was really, I wanted to be a professor of paleontology when I was a kid. And basically, Jurassic Park came out and everybody was into dinosaurs and my contrarian nature kicked in, and I went off dinosaurs after that point. True story.
Wasps and bees of all descriptions and so forth, and it was an incredible experience. And I guess what occurred to me then is that maybe this was one of the best ways to collect insects and find out what kind of insects there truly were in a representative area of the jungle. And that's just one of the more innocent things, I guess.
I also used to go to the library. And there was a little librarian in that library. She was only like 4'10". She was notably small, about 4'10". I won't dox her name, obviously, but if you're from my town, you'll know what I'm on about. And I used to go there all the time, into the library, and check out all the books on the dinosaurs. And when she see me coming, she said, oh, we've got a new one in. And she'd, you know, show me the new dinosaur books. So I was a regular dinosaur I was into taxonomy, you know, the order, suborder, species and subspecies, and there's something awesomely, if you're a little boy, there's something awesome about the way, the real autistic detail, you know, who classified them back in the Victorian era and stuff like that. It's probably all been ruined now, but it was awesome back in the day. Anyway, let's get back to Adam Curtis.
This one could read into it.
The low-flying planes cover every section of the city, from the coast of Manila Bay to the outlying environs, in an effort to destroy the large numbers of flies and mosquitoes plaguing the area. Prior to the spraying, the populace was informed that the insecticide would not injure vegetation or clothes.
In American bars, there was a drink which was called Mickey Slim, and it was a good gin with a spot of DDT in it. And this was supposed to give you a feeling of happiness and merriment.
And in Naples, in 1943 and 44, there was an enormous epidemic of typhus transmitted by the human body louse, and this, about 10 million applications of DDT dusting powder were made to people, and they wiped that out. And those things got enormous publicity in household magazines like the Reader's Digest. Everybody wanted to try DDT, and the civilian population could hardly wait to get their hands on it when it was...
They were drinking DDT with gin. Gin and DDT. Jesus Christ.
Released in 1945 for civilian use.
Well, it was sort of a miracle that happened, and by word of mouth, it spread rapidly, and I think everyone tried it. I remember one time in 1952, it was summertime, and we were going to have a birthday party right here on the lawn, right here where we're sitting. And the day before, I sprayed all the grass with water and DDT, and this got rid of the flies, and it also killed mosquitoes. And you know, flies in the afternoon while the sun's shining and mosquitoes after dark, those are two things. If you could get away from them, you could have a wonderful party out here. And we did. We had a pest-free party out here on this farm.
Chemical people would show us test plots, and the quality of the corn would have little small ears for the weeds and the insects had taken over, and where they'd used the chemicals, the ears were bigger, and with the yield was 2 to 3 times as much.
The United States was a continent plagued with insects. Farmers lived in perpetual fear of finding a new infestation. Whole crops were regularly destroyed by pests. DDT and the other insecticides invented in its wake promised victory in this war.
This man is a farmer, yes. But he is also a detective, a plant pest detective.
A giant spider. What next?
You don't in England. Anything like the insect life that we have. You don't have to have screens on the windows in many places. Can't survive here that way.
I tell you what, I don't like insects very much, friends. And I've told people, I had some fruit flies here that wouldn't bugger off. I think I finally got rid of them by making vinegar traps for literally weeks and weeks and weeks. And I think I killed them all now. But I don't like insects of any sort. If I had my way, I'd DDT the lot of them.
Just a little bit.
We are edgier about them. Anything with six legs is an enemy.
Yes, this is our enemy. Insects not only eat up our agriculture, they threaten the very health of our land.
I've seen the time full fields of crops would be ruined from the insects before the chemicals come into effect. I can remember cutworms and wireworms would absolutely clean the fields of corn and wheat. And there would be nothing left to harvest. And then when your chemicals come along, you had this to eliminate the insects, and you had your crop then.
It was a miracle chemical to us because we thought it would control practically every insect. I guess it was just a time in the period that God had decided that he would let us discover these chemicals and use them wisely. And I suppose everything, the whole system is directed by God. So I guess this was the time that we would find our knowledge given by God would lead us to find these natural resources to use, to control, do away with some of the slave labor.
The incredible success of insecticides led to a wave of invention. Chemists vied with each other to design new, more powerful products. This in turn transformed other sciences, in particular the study of insects, entomology. Entomologists had traditionally been figures of fun, eccentric scientists who spent their time classifying insects.
Classification is based.
But this was now important information for the chemical companies. They began to employ large numbers of entomologists. In the process, the focus of their science began to shift.
We were fed these new chemicals so rapidly, many of us didn't have time to do anything else but test the new chemicals. There seemed to be the chemicals being introduced into the pipeline and inexhaustible pressure to put something out the other end. And literally, we forgot about good basic entomology and became, in a sense, I think, handmaidens of the world chemical industry.
The entomologists began to discover what appeared to be serious side effects. As they investigated the effectiveness of large-scale spraying programs, they found that many other species of wildlife were being harmed.
We found out soon that there were some side effects, even as early as 1946 and 47. But the benefits were so great, we eradicated malaria from the United States, let alone many other places in the world. And so there wasn't the public pressure on. We were killing off birds in some cases. It was quite obvious that these species were disappearing starting in 47 or 48. And by 53, even the birds that lived quite a few years were beginning to disappear, and they weren't replacing themselves because the eggs weren't hatching.
Shit. This appears to be a bad side effect. I don't support the killing of birds.
These side effects led to serious disagreements among the entomologists. At their annual conference in 1953, their president made an impassioned defense of the chemicals. His speech was entitled, "The Greater Hazard, Insects or Insecticides." The choice, he said, was a simple one. Either continue spraying or return to the bad old days of starvation and disease. Everything should be done to minimize the side effects, but ultimately it was a war of survival. Insecticides had already saved 100 million human lives throughout the world.
At our scientific congresses and meetings, we were completely immersed in a haze of propaganda about chemicals. There were lavish hospitality suites, banquets sponsored by the chemical companies, and a great many entomologists were employed by these companies, and I'm sure they were absolutely convinced that what they were doing was a fundamental and a very valuable importance to the world.
Well, I mean, I guess the first thing to do would be to figure out what it was in particular that was killing the birds, see if you can isolate that, and is it the same thing that's killing the bugs? And if not, then maybe a solution could be found. Hey, I mean, that's the first question. Let's see.
The chemical companies also portrayed the battle against the insects as a necessary war. Promotional films of the 1950s invoked Charles Darwin. They depicted it as part of the inevitable struggle for existence.
Wherever man is, there the ant is also. They seem to come from nowhere and suddenly are everywhere at once, crawling over the food. As the hordes invade, man often gives up his pleasures in utter despair. It is the law of nature. The strong survive.
I'm kind of reminded a little bit of one of the comedy shows I used to watch, Lee and Herring, This Morning with Richard and Not Judy, and they had an ongoing sketch called When Things Get Knocked Over, Spill or Collide, or something like that. And the tone of it was very similar to the tone of this, the ants.
Now, in evolution, all living species are essentially in competition with each other, and the ones that are most successful survive. And insects, as has been said, will inherit the earth because they're so successful. And insects carry diseases to human beings, such as malaria, and when we spray to kill the insects, we're interfering with evolution. If evolution were to proceed, then we would be overwhelmed by the factors that are against us.
You realize...
Oh, come on. So he reckons that without insecticides, the insects would just basically, through evolution pressure, kill off all the humans through spreading malaria. Is that true? Maybe it's true. I don't know. How did human beings survive for thousands of years without insecticides then? That would be my first question. I mean, maybe. I'm just thinking with my Ed Dutton hat on here. Wouldn't Ed Dutton say, well, maybe the malaria was actually eugenic and it meant only the strongest humans survive and the insecticides are dysgenic because it means, you know, well, what do they say, 100 million people more survive or whatever. So maybe it's good not to have them and let the malaria kill off the weak. That would be the truly eugenic thing, wouldn't it? Am I wrong? I don't know. Somebody tell me.
How easy it would be for them to overcome us humans. Then instead of being the hunters, we'd become the hunted. They'd be our masters. They'd live on us.
This is very interesting, by the way, because I've been reading The Tao recently, or The Tao, as a lot of people know. I've been reading the Chinese, the Taoist masters, the three main ones, Lao Tzu, and then there are two other guys. And I've also been kind of reading around Taoism and the contrast between the East and the West and Alan Watts and all this sort of stuff as well. And one of the things that a lot of people talk about when they contrast Taoism with a kind of Western attitude is that they claim that the West always saw nature as something to be conquered, something to overcome. Whereas the Taoists obviously see nature as the way and something to kind of flow with rather than against. This is interesting because I have that in my mind and now I'm seeing this documentary and they are presenting the animal world and the insects and the other species as essentially competitors that we need to beat. Kind of interesting. Very interesting.
When people in the post-war period spoke of a struggle in nature, they were selecting one aspect of Darwin's theories that suited their time. Now, for Darwin, nature was a bloody battlefield. There were winners and losers, victors and the vanquished. But this imagery took on special significance in the Cold War years. In the American Midwest, when I was growing up, the household aerosols were called insect bombs. The point is that in these life and death struggles, scientists believed that they were seizing power from evolution and redirecting it by controlling the environment. They took it on faith from the biologists that this is how the world works. And then they chose to emphasize those aspects of Darwin's theory which fitted in best with the industrial programs they were embarked upon. This was not a neutral reading of Darwin at all. This was an interested reading.
Anything left behind?
Nothing but a dead spider.
Well, this time he's going to stay dead. Dead and buried.
Well, let's say at least until some egghead comes along and digs it up again.
The first serious public attack on the widespread use of pesticides came from Rachel Carson. She was a biologist who had worked for the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. In the late 50s, she began collecting evidence of the side effects. In particular, studies which showed that DDT was becoming more concentrated as it worked its way into the bodies of larger animals. In 1962, she wrote...
I can see where this is. I haven't seen this one, friends. I got a bit confused and forgot that I'd done The League of Gentlemen already on a previous show. This is one of the few Curtises I've not seen before. But I'm just saying that if it's getting into the bodies of larger mammals, there's only a short journey from that to the old human being. I think I can see where this is going to go. Let's see if I'm right.
A book called Silent Spring. It was an attack on the chemical companies.
It started coming out in the New Yorker. She kept it rather quiet. She knew that the chemical industry, or the part of it she was worrying about, would react. And sure enough, the official of the Velsicol Chemical Company wrote a very threatening letter to Houghton Mifflin. You must not print this book. And came out with the standard line that they still use. You see, if we stop using all these pesticides, it would simply ruin the whole economy of the country. And this is a sinister plot by the far-left subversive forces, as they called them, to destroy the United States.
Silent Spring painted a dramatic picture of a poisoned America. It caused an immediate sensation. It coincided with revelations about thalidomide and the fallout of strontium 90 from nuclear testing.
And I got the book.
Was it true, though, Adam? That's my question. Was it true? Okay, it harms birds and some animals, but fundamentally, was what she was saying true? That's my question.
When I got home, I read that, and I got about two-thirds of the way through the book, and I saw so many things I knew were not true that it bothered me. When I set out to make a lot of speeches to try to let people know what she had said and what was really the truth. Many other people were doing the same thing across the nation. So usually at some time during the talk, somebody would be interested in what about the effect on people. And it was handy at that time to have a box of DDT like this one. And so I could just dump some out in my hand.
Well, fucking hell.
And take some of it to show.
maybe there's nothing wrong with eating DDT. Fucking hell. I mean, in my mind, it's poisonous, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's perfectly safe. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. All I can do is trust these people who've studied it, like everybody else. See, this is the problem. This was the problem with L-COVID, wasn't it? You didn't know who to trust. I'm not an expert. Are you an expert? No. Am I an expert? No. That guy an expert? No. Well, trust the experts. What if the experts lie, though? Well, I don't know. This dude's eating DDT, and he's not dying, so that's kind of quite convincing.
But it's not harmful to people. Never has been. Nobody's ever been killed by DDT. I've not even heard of anybody being made ill by it, even when they attempt suicide.
In 1963, the book was made the subject of an hour-long TV special. Three of the program's sponsors, food and chemical manufacturers, withdrew in protest. Carson used the program to widen her attack on the chemical companies.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene.
I want to see you eat DDT, love. Eat the DDT and show me if you die or not.
Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. Man's attitude toward nature is today critically important, simply because we have now acquired a fateful power to alter and to destroy nature. Unless we do bring these chemicals under better control, we are certainly headed for disaster.
Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of...
Based mid-century American with a thin moustache. This is the best type of American. All the best Americans have that moustache. Tennessee Ernie Ford, Walt Disney, old era Bob Dylan, Mr. House. basically anyone who's ever had that moustache is based, in my opinion.
Nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature. If man were to faithfully follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth.
The ironic thing was how Robert White Stevens died. He died as the result of the sting of a wasp.
In 1963, Rachel Carson died. Although her book had caused an outcry, it had no immediate effect on the use of pesticides. But another attack on the chemical industry was about to be launched, this time from the suburbs.
Although the faces of America's major cities seem relatively unchanged, a quiet revolution has been taking place there for nearly a decade. More than a million persons each year have pulled up stakes in the cities and turned commuter.
America's suburbs had grown enormously during the 50s, often on land made habitable for the first time with the use of insecticides.
Now, this is of intense interest to me, friends. For the book I'm currently writing, Boomer Truth Regime, I bought that book about the suburbs here called, what's it called now? The Geography of Nowhere by Kunstler. I'm interested on the psychology of the suburb and the way the geography actually has an impact on the kind of spirit of the people and how the suburb impacted the mindset of the boomer, basically. So anything suburb, I'm interested.
But continued spraying to treat diseases such as Dutch elm now brought the side effects of the chemicals into the gardens of the wealthy and articulate middle classes.
We live in what's called the Gold Coast area, the wealthier people. And so we had money right away to buy this stuff and the machinery and the men. And so they went around and squirted, first of all, from the ground. But that didn't last very long. Soon, there was a whole page in the Sunday Milwaukee Journal on how now Shorewood and Fox Point and Bayside, where I live, were really going to take care of their elm trees. And they had a photograph of a helicopter spraying with DDT. And not too long after that, the robins started going to the vultures. And it would start out, you'd see the robin, you'd think it would be all right, and then all of a sudden the swimming would go on.
Those robins got in the way of the spray and they got drenched with DDT and they fell to the ground. There they were, twitching and paralyzed. And that seemed like a terrible thing, and it was for those robins. But there were millions of other robins that weren't being hurt at all.
Oh, I can see what's happening here. There's the involvement of women, busybody women. But I still haven't really seen, I still can't get the image out of my mind of that old fella eating DDT and being perfectly all right with it. So, you know, maybe that woman was just like literally spraying robins in the face and that killed them, you know, I mean.
You'd be awakened by this of them coming to the house. And one day I was so angry that I raced up into the attic and opened the dormer windows in my little pink nightie and I climbed up on top of the roof and I just stood there and shook my fist at them.
What happened next was that there was a spraying of DDT in Long Island, and Mrs. Yannicone didn't like it.
The first time I noticed it, I drove past here on my way home from work, and there were dead fish for about 10 feet out from the side. This is noticeable as you drive by.
The massive fish kill in this lake, and as we later found out, other lakes, were all ignored. Largely because the suburban population that was seeing this had nothing to compare it against, having come from the concrete canyons of Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens, where I came from, and not knowing what the natural state was supposed to be. The scientific community, which should have been observing all...
This guy's voice is identical to Milton Friedman's voice. Have you noticed that?
This was too busy making new products or living in their ivory towers. Let us take charge. We will bring you better things for better living through chemistry.
Victor Yanacone was a lawyer. Together with two local biologists, he founded the Environmental Defense Fund. Its aim was to legally challenge the use of DDT and other pesticides. Their argument was that the chemicals were spreading in uncontrollable ways, becoming more poisonous as they did so. One of the strongest pieces of evidence was the disappearance of the peregrine falcon. DDT was being found in their bodies, and their eggs were failing to hatch. Two ornithologists set out to count the falcon population.
We were simply going to follow a route from northern Alabama all the way up to the state of Maine. And we started in, I believe it was early April. And birds should be on location at that time. And we simply worked our way northward, and we followed a very torturous route. And we checked something like 130 sites or something like that in the course of the next 3 months, driving a little over 14,000 miles. We found zero, not one peregrine falcon.
68, the Environmental Defense Fund discovered an obscure law in the Midwestern state of Wisconsin. It allowed anyone a legal hearing if they believed they could prove water pollution in the state.
Go Northwestern, it's the very best way to go.
Using this as a pretext, the fund engineered a hearing. And in November 1968, a small group of them traveled to Madison, the capital of Wisconsin, in the heartland of America's agriculture. The hearing was held in the vast state legislature. It quickly became a trial of DDT. The star was Victor Yanacone. His main aim was to get the public's attention, to explain why tiny amounts of a chemical could have such large effects.
We had to explain that a part per million was significant. We did this by calling a very prominent scientist from the pro-DDT camp. And we asked him a very simple series of questions. Doctor, do you have any idea what the purpose of the hormones that flow in your blood is? Yeah. And they're responsible for your secondary sex characteristics, the hair on your head, the hair on your chest, the tone of your voice, right? Do you have any idea what the level of testosterone in your bloodstream is necessary to give you that lovely shock of white hair, all that hair on the chest and the grandchildren that you're so proud of? And he finally admitted that it was 5 parts per million. I said, well, do you have any idea what would happen if the level of testosterone in your blood should drop to as low as 3.5 parts per million? He averred he didn't know, and I said, well, you know that hair of yours would change, the hair on your chest would disappear, the hair on the rest of your body would change, your voice would go up to a little squeak, and you sure as hell wouldn't have any grandchildren.
Is that what's happened now? They're turning the frogs gay because there's too much DDT in the water. The
public got the point. 1 part per million could be very significant.
The Madison hearing soon became headline news, with both sides claiming that everything America stood for was at stake.
At the height of the battle over DDT, I wrote a poem and sent it to Time magazine. It was a parody on America the Beautiful, and I'll sing it for you. Oh, beautiful for bog-filled skies, for weevils in the grain. For apple scat and stableflies, please bring these back again.
I love how pro DDT this guy is, like DDT, like the old pro DDT guard. I love these guys. I don't know, my spidey sense is a thing. Like I get the sense that there's some bullshit here. I don't trust this Yanacone character. Something smells off about him. I trust this guy more.
Malaria, malaria, red blood cells harbor thee. Where Rocky Mountain fever thrives, where babies have TB, where parasites take human lives, why, that's the land for me.
Oh,
from malaria, my spleen will welcome thee. Restore the sickness ground.
He's still going, this guy.
Upon you by banning DDT.
I walked in, Yannacone looked at me long and hard and says, I think he'll do. And then he looked at me and says, can you between now and tomorrow put together a lecture of about 40 slides of all the different pictures of the Wisconsin ecosystem so it'll be not only beautiful but emotionally rich and will affect the people who listen to it? So I said, I'll try. Next day I came here and gave this talk with beautiful slides of the prairies and the woods of Wisconsin. It was, I'm sure, the first time anybody has ever shown wildflowers in the chambers of the Wisconsin legislature.
In the late 60s, ecology was a modest scientific backwater. Ecologists spent their time studying the mutual dependence and balance of all the inhabitants of a particular area. But for Yannacone, ecology was a powerful weapon with which to attack the defenders of DDT. Especially the entomologists. It gave him a scientific basis to challenge the idea of evolution they used to justify the large spraying programs.
The entomologists, who should have known better and now 30 years later admit they should have known better, simply saw the death and the extinction of what we now know to be beneficial insects as the operation of the fundamental law of survival and evolution. What they didn't realize is the kind of evolution they were looking toward was the evolution of monsters arising from garbage dumps, of chemically deformed animals and plants.
Oh, they thought, hell, come on now. Where are you getting the chemically deformed animals from? We've seen a couple of dead birds so far. I'm calling, but I reckon this lawyer was just looking for some big paydays here. I trust the DDT guys. Honestly, I'm on team DDT. DDT! DDT!
What would come out of this was a simplified world ecosystem with good plants, bad plants, weeds. Good insects, bad insects. Good animals, the ones we eat. Bad animals, the ones that take up space.
There was a problem, though. If human beings were inextricably interwoven with other parts of nature, as ecology said, where were the effects of DDT on humans? In 30 years, no worker in the DDT factories had been poisoned.
We watched a bloke eat it like it was cornflakes. I mean, we watched a man eat DDT, and he was fine, so...
The defenders made great play of this at the hearing. But then in early 1969, the Environmental Defence Fund received some unexpected news.
A Swedish chemist by the name of Göran Löfroth wrote a letter saying that they have found in almost all women in Sweden DDT in the mother's milk. Well, we went to my house, we finally said, hey, let's call up Sweden. And we did. We got him out of bed. He must have been 4 o'clock in the morning then. He spoke pretty good English. What do you want? He says, we want you in medicine. He said he would come. Thursday came and went. Friday at 10 o'clock, people went out to the airport. It was all hush, hush.
Come on, we're meant to be trusting this dude? This guy's shadier than, like, Better Call Saul or something. Come on.
Because the testimony was droning on and on and on, the pesticide this and the chickens that and the eggs this and so forth and so on. My God, when just hours, I mean, we have, after all, we have 14 of these volumes, 2,800 pages of testimony. The stenographers went bananas. Anyway, at 11:30, somebody high-hoed me, little sign, and we went outside the hall, and sure enough, there was Göran Löfroth with his little suitcase. In the meanwhile, of course, we had called the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post. All these reporters were waiting in the wings.
It's happening!
Hiya, happening!
Oh, well, hello, everybody.
And then for the next 3 hours, Göran Löfroth laid it on the line that if babies eat, drink milk, of cows that grazed on land that was sprayed with DDT. Their fat is going to contain DDT. And not only this, but its fat, of course, is in the brain. Most brain is fat. It will be loaded with DDT by Sunday, front page of the Sunday New York Times.
But baby is still a human. If DDT is not harmful for humans, so what if there's DDT in a baby's brain? It's still not, I mean, who cares? If it's not harm, we watched a bloke eat it. Presumably when he ate it, it went into his system. This is bullshit.
And the opposition was just livid with rage, but we won that one.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy, oh boy! We've got fun, we've got freedom, we've got joy!
We got fun, we got freedom, we got joy!
When I heard it was banned, I really felt bad about it because I felt it was a victory against science. And I felt that scientists and industry had a place in this country. And certainly being undermined by the statements about pesticides in general, it's gotten worse since then, of course. After banning DDT, the others were easy. Somebody said maybe because DDT was so easy to spell that people immediately thought about it.
Where once chemicals were seen as good, now they were bad. In the early 1970s, press and television became...
Backward step. I agree with the DDT bros. This was a backward step. This was a clear, you know, leftist moral panic bullshit. Oh, you know, some bloke from the New York Times is up in arms because, you know, a baby in Sweden has got DDT in their system, which is non-deadly, doesn't do anything to you, doesn't cause deformities, doesn't show any problems. So, yeah, just ban it. Tell you what, I'm going back to the Mises Institute. That's it. It's done it. Becoming a libertarian again.
Fascinated by any reports of the side effects of pesticides and herbicides.
What happened? That leg just malformed, but when he was crippled, he was born after the sprain this year. That's the only evidence in...
And above all, by the effects on human beings.
The first analysis was phoned to me yesterday to say they have found the residues of 2,4-D. So I guess I'm the first documented case to say it is residual in the human body after you've been exposed to it.
The battle against DDT had been won ultimately by evidence of its presence in humans.
Yeah, but so what if the presence is not harmful? You could probably find trace of all sorts of bullshit. I had a chocolate bar earlier on. You could probably find trace of chocolate in me. If it doesn't kill you, what's the problem?
Now the Environmental Defence Fund placed advertisements in the national papers implying that DDT caused cancer. Donations flooded in, but the decision split the leadership.
The Environmental Defence Fund and Carol and I parted company over the issue of whether the shift should be from the questions that we were sure of, that DDT was bad for the environment, to the speculation that DDT might cause cancer. I don't believe in going to court on speculation. I go to court on relatively solid evidence. DDT...
So you look at the concept creep now. You've gone from, oh, we found some in a woman and now it causes cancer. Bullshit, it does. Science corrupted and perverted by rubbish, by a stupid American legalism.
DDT is not good for mammalian systems. It damages the nervous system. It damages the liver enzyme systems. It causes some problems. It is not a strong carcinogen. It is not, except in very large doses, associated with serious human health hazard. Its real problem is that it had the capacity, had it continued to be used at the rate it was being used, to literally destroy almost the entire world natural ecological system on which we really depend, and would have meant the ultimate collapse of the human species as...
Well, what are you basing that on? A couple of dead robins and a couple of dead fish in a... I mean, you still haven't shown evidence that it would have completely killed all life on Earth. Where has he extrapolated that from? This is just classic, like, Nadler moral panic bullshit. I'm sorry. The old dude eating DDT like cornflakes was right.
A animal species.
The DDT hearing was a watershed, not just for the battle against chemical pollution, but for the science of ecology. Ecologists became influential figures, giving scientific advice in the battles against other pesticides. But in the process, their science was transformed. It became the guiding force of the environmental movement.
Beginning with the unintended consequences of DDT, the science of ecology had emerged as a useful tool in science, and many people began to see it as something that could be drawn upon for moral enlightenment as well, the notion of everything being connected to everything else.
It's the relationship between me and plants and animals and the world in general.
I remember the first time I ever heard the word environmentalist on the air was on an Arthur Godfrey show, and he was trying to explain what it was, and it was hard for him to explain what the era was. So it was really a new era.
Some people have a deep, abiding respect for the natural beauty that was once this country.
Oh, here we go. DDT, DDT, DDT.
And some people don't. People start pollution. People can stop it.
2 days ago, a man whose controversial predictions of a forthcoming global catastrophe have made him an international figure arrived at London's Heathrow Airport. He is Paul Ehrlich, professor of biology at Stanford University, California, and the chief spokesman for the so-called ecological movement.
Dr. Ehrlich, just how realistic is your projected theory of the eco-catastrophe?
Well, I think that it's getting more realistic all the time. The signs are getting worse, but I still have considerable hope because although governments are very slow, people all over the world are awakening very rapidly.
Out of a snoz on him, isn't there? Out of a snoz.
What the real danger is.
In much the same way as the science of entomology had been changed in the 1950s, now ecology was transformed by the social and political pressures of the early 70s. Ecologists became the moral and spiritual guardians of a new view of the human relationship to nature. And they too cited Darwin's laws to prove that their view was correct.
Nature has a set of laws that all organisms have to obey by necessity, because that's the way they evolved, and this applies to human beings very much so. If we need to introduce into our lives nature, it is a need that is enormously deep. Look around you wherever you go into homes. There are not only living flowers, they're not only aquaria and pets. Look at the wall. What do we see? Sunflowers by Van Gogh or irises by Van Gogh.
Mate, but listen, right? If I was living out in the bloody African prairie and a lion tried to kill me, I'd have to kill the lion, right? If I was starving, I'd have to kill a bloody deer to eat the deer. And if I'm trying to plant some corn in a field and some insects try to eat it, I'm well within my rights to kill the insect. This is nature's way. What's he on about? I don't understand. I'm with the DDT guys 100%.
Or pictures, photographs of landscapes. You don't see framed in a house a picture of a crankshaft from a Ford. Or a tin can squashed. Now, in modern art, which is a sick art, because it reflects the confusion in the human minds, yes, indeed.
Darwin's so big that he can support any number of generalizations about the world. I mean, given Darwin's image as a scientific saint, people inevitably try to get him on the side of their view of nature. Now, Darwin was complex. In The Origin of Species, for example, the metaphors tumble over one another in the most unscientific way. Sure, nature's seen as being at war, but nature's also likened to a web of complex relations. Here, then, was another aspect of Darwin for people to seize on for their own purposes. Darwin gave them a basis for urging us not to take control of nature, but to cooperate with it, to stay with it.
I'm sorry, right, but this is all bullshit, because this guy is not above flattening the ground to build a house. Presumably he lives in a house. He's not above, you know, that building he's standing in. All of that was nature once. Trees had to be chopped down. The ground needed to be leveled. It needed to be paved over. It needed to be transformed to be habitable for humans, to be habitable for him. He's for all of that. What's the difference between that and using a bit of DDT on your crops? That's my question.
And it's balance. Again, Darwin serves up slogans. In the popular imagination, scientific theories are something fixed, and if they're good theories and accepted by creditable people, then they're absolute, and that's that. What people don't understand is that scientific theories never have a single meaning. They become a cultural property. They are usable, serviceable for different interested parties.
Gracious, what a scandal, every other girl would cry. She can't hold a candle to somebody such as I. But who got the banker's boy and 50,000 quid?
The story of DDT continues. The head of a large property company has called a press conference to announce that he has stopped construction in one of his skyscrapers.
Yeah.
Let me move over this side to have a more light.
What's happening here this morning?
Well, the peregrine falcons have been nesting in this building for 5 years. And every year, the Peregrine Society comes and retrieves the eggs. The eggs will not hatch here because due to DDT contamination, they're too weak for the bird to sit on.
We're going to open the window.
Good, would you?
Yeah, quick. Okay.
Whoa, man. Somebody's pushing it.
Okay, take it easy. Each year they bring back a small baby for the bird so that they feel that they've completed the cycle.
Okay. You all, did you want to come in closer?
Basically, the people are here because it's not just a story about the eggs being laid and gathered. It's a story about how this particular developer, the J.H. Snyder Company, has literally suspended construction in this area during the mating season of these particular birds, and how it's an excellent idea of how developers and business people can participate in environmental concerns.
Come on.
Plenty of time, he's going to stay.
That woman's voice was so kind of high-pitched and fast. She sounded like when you do the, you know, sometimes on YouTube you can do like the double speed. She sounded like a double speed. She sounded like it sped her up.
Does everybody have everything they need in the way of shots?
You saw the number of TV cameras and the media people that were up here today watching the manipulation going on. This, in effect, is really a myth being born or being fostered at any rate.
Looking out from the ledge 26 floors above Wilshire Boulevard, it's hard to believe that the falcons would pick an urban area like this to nest.
The myth in this case is that the peregrine falcon is sacred. Granted, it's a precious species. We were about to lose it perhaps a number of years ago. Now we have peregrines back in good numbers. There have been dramatic recoveries. I think it's just an unrealistic attitude about how sensitive parts of nature are.
At the start of the DDT litigation in 1966, science had become the way that the human beings could avoid responsibility. Science would take care of us. After the DDT wars, we knew that science was not necessarily going to be the answer. But mankind in the 20th century still wanted to avoid responsibility for their own individual actions. Now it's nature that's going to permit us to shift the responsibility from human beings to some force that we don't have to take responsibility for.
What we're talking about is a very profound internal shift of attitude and of values. This is the gift of ecology to human beings and really to all species today. And that gift can give rise to not utopia, but ecotopia, which is this profound sense of place, the sense of coming home at last.
The kinds of ideas about ecology and...
I mean, she can say that, but what if you die of malaria, love? I mean, you wouldn't be saying that if you were dying of malaria. You'd be like, give me the science to save my life. I don't know. I'm kind of caught between two views in this particular one.
Environment that we see today, I don't believe, are any more scientific or rational than previous notions of nature. In both cases, people that talk about them are saying, look, this is scientific. I'm not making this up. These are not my hopes and dreams. This is what science tells us. But in both cases, I think what you can see happening is particular kinds of social ideals being read back to us as if they were lessons derived from science itself. In the case of contemporary ecology, it seems to me what we're actually getting is a kind of utopia of a perfectly constructed, complex universe of natural things. And from that universe, one tries to derive various kinds of laws that can help us live better as human beings.
I think it is a moral lesson. There is a possibility for a kind of utopia. We've dreamed about it, and that possibility exists in our future.
The scientific and technological notions of the 1950s, the ideas of endless possibilities for exploitation of nature, are now seen as ill-conceived and ill-guided. I'm haunted by the possibility that the ideas of ecology that we now embrace today may, in 30 or 40 years, seem similarly ill-conceived. And they're no more scientific than, let's say, other notions of nature that we have looked to in the past.
But here's the thing, right? They must still use pesticides. They must still spray the... There's no way they do mass industrial farming without some sort of insecticide. Or do farmers just let caterpillars eat all their crops? That doesn't happen. So they still use pesticides. They just don't use DDT. They use some other one. So, you know.
Past.
At least when science was our god, we felt that we were actively doing something. We were in control. Now there are too many people that say, there's nothing I can do. Nature will take care of it. I just will continue fat, dumb, and happy the way I am. We must go back to the simple lesson of history. Every human being concerned enough, dedicated enough, and willing to make the sacrifice can change the world around them.
In 1860, Charles Darwin wrote to a friend in America about whether it is possible to seek divine providence in nature. I feel most deeply, he said, that the whole subject is too profound for the human intellect. A dog might as well speculate on the mind of Newton. Let each man hope and believe what he can.
Come on, folks. We just gotta get to the top.
Top? Top of what?
Why, the top of the... Oh, gosh. I just can't believe
it. This is kind of an interesting one from Curtis, because it's almost Foucauldian, this episode, where he's basically showing that whatever happens, you have a truth regime, you have a kind of morality and a worldview that comes prior to science, and that it's going to be used, which whatever the actual facts are, it's going to be used one way or the other. Interesting. We're going to hold a vote when this finishes. In fact, I'm going to put it up now as this finishes. We're going to hold a vote as to whether you're pro DDT or anti DDT. Let's have a look. Well, I'm going to put DDT in my cornflakes. And then we're going to put ban it. See which one wins. And then now we'll let this play out.
I was
was sure it would be here.
Oh, sure. Keep going. Stick together. Everything's going to be just lovely when we get to the top. Well, we're at the top, and where's this paradise we heard so much about?
Do you think we'll ever know what's best?
We will one day, but it won't be here on Earth in our lifetime. We'll know when we get to heaven, we'll know what's best.
Oh, look! Look, everybody, look!
Starlight Square.
Happening!
In the castle, on the corner, there's a cloud bank, and we bank our winnings there.
Look at the human!
And there it is. Well, a fascinating episode. I hadn't seen that one before. And I don't know. My instincts tell me that the side, the bandit, were basically making stuff up. That's what it seemed like to me. It had all the hallmarks of a moral panic and all the hallmarks of just like emotional bullshit and women and fucking lawyers and hippies and, you know, it was all bullshit. It was obviously rubbish. Now, whether it was causing, you know, would have eradicated all wildlife, that's a claim I'd like to see more of. I'd like to kind of look into the papers that have been done on this issue. But instinctually, I reckon that was a mountain out of a molehill, personally. But anyway, I will have to come back to that. Let's have a look to see how the people have voted. 45% said they want DDT in their cornflakes. They were the abased old men. 55% said ban it. Oh, it's moved to 46-54. So the Bannets have won. But I don't know. I have very attuned bullshit meters. And to me, it seemed like on the balance, there was more bullshit coming out of the mouths of the ban crowd. Just reminded me of so many other kind of stupid. I remember, like, if it was South Park, Kyle's mother would have been on that side. Kyle's mother would have been on the side of banning it. Anyway, let's hit some super chats and then we'll get out of here. And it's ironic because I've been reading the Tao, as I've said, but I don't know. I don't know what the... It's hard to say what the Taoists would, you know, if they'd be against pesticides or not, because their answer to everything is like, well, you know, like, that's for the emperor to figure out. I'm just going to sit here by the river like the turtle. So they're kind of hard to pin down on questions like that. Anyway, Coney says, DDT played havoc on the raptor population in Britain, like the peregrine falcon. DDT accrued at the top of the food chain, like mercury in tuna. It made their eggs too soft and they would break too easily. Okay, well, I mean, just stop the... I mean, there must be a way of stopping certain animals going to the areas where you're using DDT. Have a peregrine falcon zone, I guess. I don't know. I mean, maybe it was right to ban it. I don't know. I've never seen this documentary before. Coney said, in Chinese philosophy, the legalist school that Qin Shi Huang and the Ming dynasty subscribed to also believed in conquering and overcoming nature. For example, in their attitude towards water management. Yes. I remember reading about those chaps at some point. I also remember in the history of ancient China, there's a huge amount of canal building projects that goes on. Huge amount of canal building projects in China's history. Spasticus Autisticus says, ironic that bug men are the result of insecticides. Well, it turns out that the bug men are the result of banning them. But I'd be interested to know what insecticides replace DDT. Some countries actually still use insecticides, even though it was banned in Britain and America 30 odd years ago. It's still used in some places. But what insecticides are used in America? What insecticides are used in the USA? Okay, so they use different ones now. They use something called chlorpyrifos, which is a pesticide. So they still use them. But, they just don't use DDT. So there we go. It says that, according to this fact sheet I've got, it is estimated that more than 67 million birds are killed by pesticides each year in the United States still. And between 6 and 14 million fish are killed by pesticides each year in the United States still. So that happens now, even despite banning DDT. So there we are. Maybe, you know, and it hasn't wiped out all bird life or fish life in America, is it? So, you know. Blue Wizrobe says the crying Indian in the commercial was played by an Italian in the grand tradition of Chief J. Strongbow. He was another Italian who played an Indian. Adam East says the geography of nowhere is a good read. Constler's style echoes Tom Wolfe, in my opinion. Constler is very based and does podcasts. Have him on Cigar Stream. Yeah, I noticed that Constler is still alive and supports Trump, believe it or not. I thought he would have been a lifelong Democrat, but he's a Trump supporter now, which surprised me greatly. So if he was up for it, I'd have him on Cigar Stream. Anyway, that is it, I think, for Super Chats. Said I'd keep this short and sweet. I'll be back on Monday for Cigar Stream. There's still a mellow moment tomorrow and on Friday. But I'll just remind everyone, do buy courses at the academic agency, logic and writing and all the trivium and entrepreneurship and economics and all the other courses. But most importantly of all, ladies and gentlemen, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.